It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, many houses in Wisconsin have a history going way back before their current owners moved in. With a little work, you can learn the history of your home. We'll talk with an expert about hunting for the story of our house. First, a wave of teacher strikes around the country has hit Oklahoma now and Kentucky. Teachers there walked out of classes today and rallied at their state capitals for higher wages and more education funding. The demonstrations come after growing protests in Arizona over the weekend. The protests are fueled in part by the recent success of teachers striking in West Virginia earlier this year. The demonstration there shut down schools for 9 days and resulted in a 5% raise for teachers. Madeline Will is a reporter for Education Week who covers the teaching profession. She also writes for the blog Teacher Beat. Madeline, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's hit these states one at a time. First of all, what is the latest now in Oklahoma?
So today was the first day of a statewide walkout. About 200 school districts closed as teachers marched to the Capitol and protested for higher funding. They actually received a $6,000 pay raise last week, but they're saying that's not enough. They need more. They're calling for $75 million in education funding after a decade of steep cuts to the profession.
And you said it's the first day, and it seems unclear to some school districts if there's going to be a second or third day of these walkouts, right?
Yeah, so the State Teachers Union has said that the walkout will continue tomorrow, and many districts have shut down classes for tomorrow, but beyond that, it's really up in the air.
And then take us over to Kentucky. What's happening there?
So Kentucky teachers are protesting at the Capitol today because they're fighting for their pension benefits. The state legislators have passed a pension reform bill last week, and teachers are protesting the changes to their retirement. Most school districts are closed for spring break already, but a few districts have been shut down.
And now people are also watching for a possible walkout now in Arizona, is that right?
Yes, the teachers are asking for a 20% pay raise and threatening to strike if they don't get that.
Talking to Madeline Will from the publication Education Week, looking at teacher strikes around the country. And Madeline, I want to dig deeper into the one that's getting the most attention, Oklahoma. You've talked to teachers there. What are you hearing from them about wages, school funding, and why they're walking out?
The teachers in Oklahoma have said they don't want to walk out. They're worried about their students. This is happening during state testing. They're not sure what's going to happen with that, but they feel like they have no other option. Aside from the pay raise that happened last week, teachers hadn't received a pay raise in 10 years. And Oklahoma has one of the steepest cuts in funding to education over the past decade. So teachers feel like this is the only way they can get the legislature to notice them.
And are teachers in Oklahoma pointing toward what had happened earlier this year in West Virginia?
Yes, they're saying that showed them that this kind of movement could be successful, that they could get what they need, and to some extent, that's already proved to be true. I mean, it's a big deal for Oklahoma to pass a $6,000 pay raise.
Can you talk about how teachers' salaries and compensation compare to people with comparable levels of training and education? You wrote a big piece on that recently.
Yeah. So, teachers in general, they're paid much differently than other college-educated professionals. A teacher can't walk into his or her boss's office and negotiate a salary. It's really based on a salary schedule that is determined by the district and how much money they have and by the states and how their minimum schedules. And as state legislators have to do more with less, they just haven't been able to put that money into teacher raises in many states.
And one thing that seems unusual about this wave of walkouts and strikes is it's not always the teachers' unions leading the way. Can you talk about how these things developed?
Yeah, these teachers are all organizing on Facebook. There's one teacher Facebook group in Oklahoma that has more than 70,000 members. These states are all red states. The unions are not as strong as they have been in the past. So this is a really grassroots movement. Teachers are driving this protest.
And so, ironically, places where teachers have fewer collective bargaining rights, we're seeing more labor action and more walkouts there?
Right, right. Striking is actually illegal in Oklahoma, West Virginia, in Kentucky, but in West Virginia, teachers were not punished for striking. I think Oklahoma teachers are hoping the same.
And so what happens next in Oklahoma in particular? Is there any sign that lawmakers in that state are looking to increase wages more than they already had done?
It's not clear right now. Last week was a really, it takes a lot of, it's a big deal for Oklahoma to pass any kind of tax increase. Both chambers at the legislature have to have a 3/4 majority vote. That's a lot to get through. So the governor has said teachers should be thanking legislators for getting that pay raise through. So it's not clear if they'll be able to pass another one.
Yeah, what have Oklahoma teachers said about that pay raise and education funding increase that had passed there?
They're saying that's a good start. They're appreciative, but they're saying it's just not enough to make up for the last decade.
Is there a thought that these are just the first few dominoes falling here, that other teachers in other states are going to be watching these stories?
I think they are watching these stories. I think there's rumblings. No other state has as firm of plans as these four, but I think a few months ago people would have said that this couldn't have happened. So I think people are watching this very closely.
And where do states like the ones we're talking about, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Kentucky, stack up when it comes to how teachers are paid?
So the average salary for teachers is about $58,000 nationally. In Oklahoma, teachers make about $45,000. Arizona is also pretty low on the list. So these teachers, they have suffered cuts over the years. Their raises are not up to par.
And then in Oklahoma, we've heard a lot about funding of education and stories of some school districts going to 4-week schedules, shortages of textbooks and things like that. Do you see that as a widespread issue there?
Yes, in Oklahoma, yes. I spoke with a district superintendent who have said that they, want to have more support staff for their students with special needs. They want to have, more counselors, and they just can't afford it.
So in Oklahoma and elsewhere, what are you watching for next?
Well, I think it'll be really interesting to see what the legislature does with Oklahoma and with Arizona, to see if Arizona teachers are able to get the legislature to pass an increase in teacher pay.
Madeline, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Madeline Will, reporter for Education Week. She was with us to talk about a growing number of teacher strikes and walkouts around the country. Right now, if you live in a house that has had previous owners, it might be a home to you and to decades of history, maybe a century or more. Some of our listeners have already posted on our Facebook page about their house history hunt. We heard from Steve on Facebook, who learned the professions and family members of all the past owners of his 112-year-old Victorian house. He met the daughter-in-law of the family who built that house, and she gave him a picture from 1909 when the house was the only one on the block. But you might be like Annika, who would love to know more about her house built in 1905, or Mike, who's learned how difficult it can be to find info about his ancient log cabin in Iron County. Our guest today may have some guidance for you. You can join in if you have questions about looking for the history of your house at 800-642-1234, or if you have done some digging and have a story to share. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Joe DeRose is with us now. He's been the Wisconsin Historical Society's survey historian for over 25 years. He's a member of the Historical Society's Speaker Bureau and gives presentations on topics including how to research a building's history. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Rob, for having me.
Well, what are some of the reasons that people get into digging into the history of their house?
Well, it gives a personal connection to it. A lot of times people are looking for someone famous or some elaborate story that happened, and that while that does happen, most of these houses are very mundane, but they still have stories to tell and they are unique.
Let's get into how we do this. There's an easy way and a hard way, I discovered looking around on your website. On your website, some people have done the homework on a lot of buildings around the state. Tell us how we can get to that.
Certainly. Our website is wisconsinhistory.org. And what we have is something called the Wisconsin Architecture History Inventory, or AHI for short. This inventory has information on over 145,000 buildings around the state of Wisconsin. So it's a great way to, it's the first step I would take to find out about your house, because if the digging's been done, it'll save you a lot of work.
Yeah, and I was poking around on there looking for houses I had lived in and some others. And some of it is kind of just nuts and bolts when it was built and style and things like that. But if people have done a lot of work, there are notes in there that have a lot more history, right?
Sure. Ever since this website went live about 10 or 15 years ago, I get a couple of dozen of these updates every day where people will tell me about their house, and they are diligent, to say the least. I mean, the amount of information they give me concerning the history of their home, it's very personal to them, and it's very accurate, and it's a great source of history.
And is this largely crowdsourced, or is this partly the Historical Society has done some of this work and homeowners have done some of it too?
A little bit of both. My office has a pot of money where we fund architectural surveys of communities where professionals are hired and they document the history of houses. A lot of our information comes through that way, but a lot of it comes from just folks that own the home.
And this isn't just what people might think of as the historically significant houses, the first house built in the city or the town founder's home. This could be any mostly older house, right?
Certainly, yeah. One of the homes I owned was in Stoughton, which is a very heavily Norwegian community in Dane County. And when I researched the history of it, I found out that it was owned by was built by Norwegians.
No surprise there.
But it was very poignant in the fact that they were living the American dream. Ole and Helen, they were in their 50s when they built their first home in the United States, and so we were like caretakers of their prize.
Yeah, does that make you feel different to know some of that history when you go into your house and thinking about Ole and Helen?
Oh, certainly. It makes it alive. You hear about these immigration stories of people, and it's one thing to read it in a book. It's another thing to actually live in it. And it's like, here, people came here in the 1890s, took them 20 years to save the money to build this house, and here it is. It's nothing fancy, not special. It's not historically significant, but it's very personal to these folks.
And as these stories accumulate on your website, is it just supposed to be about, you know, the first owner, the people who had the home built, or if it was built in the 1890s, it'd be interesting to hear, you know, the World War II era people who lived there or wherever?
Certainly. Most of the information on our website pertains to the first owners, but we're trying to gather those other stories. For instance, we have a project going on in Milwaukee where we're looking at the history of a home. It was built in the 1890s, but the significance lies in the fact that in the 1920s and 1930s, hotels were segregated in Milwaukee, and African Americans could not find a place to stay. Entertainers, they would stay in this house because it was the only place that they could stay, and that was not the original owner of the house.
We're talking to Joe DeRose from the Wisconsin Historical Society about hunting for the history of our houses. He has advice on how to do that, and you can join in with your questions or what you've learned in looking at the history of maybe a house you've lived in. Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hi.
Hello. Thank you.
What'd you want to bring up, Tim?
Well, I live in a house that was built in 1946, a post-World War II house designed by Hernischwager. They're a company, I believe, in Two Rivers, Wisconsin, and it was a prefab house. It was built in May 1946, and it was built specifically for returning veterans.
Oh. And so you want to find out how to get more info about that, Tim. And I imagine there's a lot of houses that popped up in 1946 for returning veterans. If someone wanted to dig more into the history of a house like that, and maybe this is getting more into the more difficult method if it isn't popping up on your website, how could somebody like Tim get started learning more?
Well, Tim's actually very knowledgeable. He's absolutely correct about Hernischwager being a prefab company out of Two Rivers, Wisconsin. A lot of people, when they hear of prefabricated houses, they think of Sears Roebuck houses, mm-hmm. but they were just one of many companies that made prefabricated houses. Hernischwager, my office actually has a file on the Harnisch-Fager company. So, Tim, if you want to get in touch with me, I'd be happy to send you a copy of that information to learn more about the company. But because the property was built after World War II, Madison and some of the larger communities in the state, they have building permits from the early 20th century. So it would be pretty easy to contact the city and find out what the building permit has. It'll tell them who the original owner was, the cost of the house. Be prepared for sticker shock. These things cost about $1,500 to $3,000.
Pre-inflation, yeah.
Yes, very, very, very inexpensive by today's standards, we would think. But it would also give a list of contractors and a great way of finding how buildings have been added onto through the years.
And even if you're not in a bigger city, there are local resources, right, in any community around the state. Where would we go to make that first step?
Sure. The easy part is to take a look, see if there's a building permit. But like I said, they don't exist in smaller communities until after the war or in rural areas until after World War II. So a good source of starting is what are known as area research centers. These are satellites, if you will, of the Wisconsin Historical Society archives, and they're mainly headquartered at the main UW campuses around the state, like at River Falls, Platteville, UW-Milwaukee, et cetera. And they have information, the types of information you would need. For instance, tax records are the best way of finding out when a property was built because, like today, your taxes are based on the value of the property. A vacant lot is not going to be as valuable as a building. It's common sense, but that's the way it works. So instead of plowing through decades of tax records, you would start looking at historic maps of an area and see if it shows up on one map and not another. In urban areas, we have what are known as Sanborn fire insurance maps, which are online at the Historical Society. And they were done in a series of years. Prior to 1920, we have these on our website. People can look and they can see how a neighborhood has changed. And if you see it on a 1910 map, but not on a 1900 map, you know the building was probably constructed during that time period. And then you can fine-tune your tax record research.
Tim, thanks for that call and happy hunting. I will go next to Kevin in Black Earth. Kevin, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I was just curious if there's a different approach to take if it's a rural property such as a farm.
Okay, hunting for our farm history.
Yeah, these are a little more difficult. Rural properties are always a little more difficult to research because they don't have the amount of documentation historically tied to them. I mentioned tax records are a great way to look when a building was constructed because you're looking for this change in value. Well, that's very simple if you're dealing with a house in a community. If you're dealing with a farm, you're not quite sure if what you're looking at is the house being constructed or the dairy barn being constructed, something like that. A good source to use to help narrow down your search is an architectural guidebook. A very good one is called A Field Guide to American Houses. It was written by a husband and wife team of Virginia and Lee McAllister. This book is commonly available at libraries and online as well. But it has pictures of different architectural styles, and you can take a look at how your building looks and what is in the book, and you can see when approximately it was built. And that's a good way of fine-tuning then your tax record research.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Want to share some more stories from our Facebook page. Jim, speaking of prefab houses, Jim says his house is a Montgomery Ward kit house built in 1930, parts shipped here from a plant in Davenport, Iowa. Wards did the original financing, had to foreclose in 1940, and then the owners immediately prior bought it at that time. And Jim says we purchased it from their estate in 1992. So it sounds like they did some detective work here to trace the provenance, I guess, of their house.
Yeah, that's very common. Like I said, these prefab houses were very common. A good way to find out if your house is one of these prefab houses is to look either in the attic or in the basement on the studs. They're marked with the name of the company, and a lot of research has been done on these various companies.
And we also heard from Mark, who says his house was built over an old cemetery. It's been an asylum and a butcher shop before becoming a residence to many. It sounds like Mark could write a good horror movie, Cemetery, Asylum, and Butcher Shop. But we could find a lot of history, and it's not always residential history for a house.
Certainly. part of what my office does, I deal with historic buildings, but my office at the Historical Society also deals with archaeological sites. So we'd be able to possibly give them some information on what was there before the buildings were constructed. I'd be very interested to learn more about the cemetery. Is it actually there, or is it folklore?
That's true. That might just be the local legend about the house. Let's talk about one of our listeners named Michael used land plat maps at the County Historical Society. Can you talk about reading those and what we can learn from them?
Sure. These plat maps are they show land ownership, and they're still in use today. And they will, they show buildings in some cases, but they show who owned the land and the acreage. And these plat maps are found at these area research centers scattered around the state, and it's a great way of finding out who owned the land historically.
Now, you go around the state doing presentations on this. I've seen your PowerPoint. Do people get hooked on this like they do on genealogy? Once you start digging in, you want to keep learning more?
Well, that's the fascinating thing about it. I have found kind of a disconnect between genealogists and building researchers.
Really?
To me, it should go hand in hand, because if you don't know the stories of the families that live there, you just have a structure. And the genealogist, on the other hand, you have these stories. They had to live and work somewhere. I try to combine the two. And when I do it, it makes for a very interesting story.
Well, and briefly, once you have the name of the people who lived there, you can start turning to other resources, right, to learn about the owners and what they did.
Sure. That's the key. Once you get the name of the owner, then you can put on your genealogical hat, and you can go to websites like Ancestry.com, and you can plug in the name, and you can find the federal census records. We've been doing censuses ever since we've been a country. You can find out all the people that lived in the house. You can find out their occupations. You can find out their level of education, things like that.
We'll leave it there for now. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Joe DeRose, survey historian at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He joined us to talk about researching the history of our homes. Now it's the first Monday of the month, which means it's time for another edition of Mondays with Mike. Each month, Wisconsin Public Radio Director Mike Crane or Director of Content Mike Arnold, both conveniently named Mike, joins Central Time or the morning show to talk about what's going on with WPR programming and operations. Mike Crane with us today, and you, if you'd like, at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have, or concerns, or praises, or criticisms do you have about WPR shows or news coverage? What do you want to hear more or less of on Wisconsin Public Radio? And what do you want to know about how we do stuff here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be here.
Well, let's be real timely to start. We've got an election day tomorrow. We've been working up to that for a while, and we've got some election night coverage coming up.
That's right. We also, just a little while ago, we had our debates that were broadcast over the weekend, and this is for the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, and we'll have the candidates being talked about in the other side, the election, which happens tomorrow. And we'll have reports all the way through the evening on the Ideas Network.
Right, and I think Sean Johnson is going to be bringing us up to date. I told him, close election, he could be here till 3 in the morning, maybe.
Could be.
Or maybe not.
Yeah.
And then speaking of elections, and we're going to talk about this later on the show, Mike, this new project from our news team at WPR, Beyond the Ballot. They're trying to find out what issues are important to people around the state. Tell us a little bit about how this is going to work.
Sure. You know, there's always some kind of an acronym or something that people use when they're talking about things, and the news department sometimes says, well, we need to talk to the RPs, the real people. Mm-hmm. And so what they're trying to do with the Beyond the Ballot is to move beyond the kind of wonky discussions that are inevitably part of what's going on, the experts, to, in a way, the real experts, which are the people of Wisconsin. And so the idea is to meet people where they are, not just on the radio, although that's going to be part of it, but in communities around the state.
Yeah, and that's a great way to think about it. And we hear from our callers, and you know, you hear the surveys and the polls and the projections from political scientists, and those are all interesting and worth talking about. But then hearing what people are actually saying, and sometimes they fit the models perfectly, and sometimes they really don't. And there's a lot of different motivations and ways of thinking out there.
Well, and if there's anything that's been striking in the coverage of the elections in the last 5 or 10 years even, it's that the pundits think one thing, and or two or five or ten things, but sometimes, as you say, the reality is a little bit different. So connecting with what are really is on people's minds is an important part of what we do.
We'll talk to Bridget Bowden, WPR reporter, about that in a bit. And by the way, there's a hotline you can join and tell us what's on your mind this election season. Call in at 877-782-8942. Again, 877-782-8942, or email beyondtheballot@wpr.org. You can listen to people's stories at wpr.org/ballot. Let's bring on a caller now. We've got George on the line in Beaver Dam. George, hi.
Hi, how you doing? My wife and I were driving back from Colorado this past weekend from spring break, and we were listening to NPR and then CNN and Fox News, and it's real interesting, the different kind of flavors. I'd have to say NPR is probably more in the middle, which maybe you haven't heard before, but I'm wondering if NPR could, or WPR could try and do some programming that has a little bit more conservative bent, but based on, you know, have some logic and fact to it other than just opinions like some other programs tend to do.
So, George, you're saying that some of what you've heard that's of a conservative bent doesn't contain those features? Is that, tell us more about that.
No, I'm talking about a lot of the talk shows we were listening to on Fox on the way back. They were just more, you know, opinions and talk show hosts saying, this is what I think, but not really backed up by facts or data or anything like that. And as we know, there's a good conservative population in the U.S. and Wisconsin, and I'm a little bit more on the conservative side. I'm just wondering if there can be some programming that kind of defends that or talks that way.
Well, thanks for the comment, George, and certainly the effort that we try to make, not just with the talk shows, but also with our news, is to aim at what you're talking about, which is to dig into the facts and how people should understand the issues of the day. And it's a good reminder for us to just make sure that we're pushing hard on that so that we're telling all kinds of stories from all the sides. And that is definitely our approach. Thanks, George.
George, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Tom on the line in Port Wayne. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have a question for Mike. This is in regards, I'm a vice chair of the Republican County Party, and we have a hard time getting Republican candidates to go on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm a 40-year listener to Wisconsin Public Radio, but they always shy away because of the heavy bias and the favoritism towards Democrats. And I hear it every year on every race from the candidates. They don't want to go to Wisconsin Public Radio. And I would like to know what Wisconsin Public Radio is going to do to level the playing field for some of our candidates.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Tom. That, quite honestly, is not my experience of how our journalists approach these things. And it is unfortunate that there is that perception, because basically what would happen to anyone who's a guest here from any party is that a lot of the opportunity is to interact with our listeners, and I really hope that that's something they would like to do. And, you know, we really try really hard to be straight arrows and not take sides. Perceptions sometimes are different than what we think is the reality, whoever we are, but that is our aim.
And when we're doing an election, we used to call them forums, and we have discussions with candidates, and he mentioned candidates specifically, if we're going to do a race, and a lot of times that's a statewide race or a congressional race, our rule is for a primary, if you're on the ballot in that primary, we invite the candidates, and then in the general, we invite anybody on the ballot. So we give the same invitation, and we try almost to the, and I'm talking for the talk shows here, mm-hmm. try as close as we can to the second to have about the equal time
yep.
for each candidate on the ballot.
Yeah, it's disappointing that is the perception, and I think kind of along the lines that George was talking about earlier, we really at Public Radio try to be right down the middle.
My favorite candidates, I know I'm not supposed to express a bias,
oh, okay.
And my favorite elected officials, the ones who call us back and come on our show. I really like them, any party. Thanks a lot for the call, Tom. I appreciate you calling in. You can join in with your thoughts or questions, not just on election coverage, anything you want to bring up about Wisconsin Public Radio. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Mike, speaking of non-election related news, hey, some fun news, WPR's pilot program beta launching this Saturday. It's been a while in the making. It's coming on both of our networks.
Well, it's funny, you know, I was thinking, reading how Doug, the host, has described things. He says beta is a polyphonic mosh pit where high culture and low culture collide. That sounds very much like Doug.
It does.
A lot of fun. One thing that struck me in thinking about it is during the pilot phase, and this I think would depict the kinds of stories you would get, is that I had not known this. In Cold War Russia, there was a battle to battle back from state-imposed prohibition of banned music. Some entrepreneurial Soviet citizens actually used the plastic from X-rays to make surreptitious recordings.
And wow.
Really fascinating. And Doug digs in deep in a very different way. And do we have a clip to play?
We do, yeah. Here's Doug talking to comedy writer Neil Scovell.
I read in an interview you said that you think that empathy is undervalued in a lot of comedy writers' rooms.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if this means that comedy writers are creating characters who are lacking in empathy and that the majority of characters we see are a bunch of unsympathetic, self-obsessed characters, or am I extrapolating too much here?
No, I love that theory. If I had thought of it myself, I would have put it in the book.
Put it in the paperback and just give me a thanks. Thanks, Doug Gordon, at the end.
I think that's incredibly smart. You should write an op-ed about it.
Okay. Thanks, Neil.
Doug Gordon talking to Nell Scovell. My aged eyes read that as Neil Scovell. Ah. But yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. When, Mike, can we hear this?
Well, anytime online at WPR.org/beta. But on the radio, Saturdays at 11, it replaces one of the plays of Says You. We had been repeating that program. So Saturdays 11 here on the Ideas Network. And also on the NPR News and Classical Network, Saturdays at 9, and that replaces a repeat of a part of Weekend Edition, so it'll be fresh programs there instead.
And this is a weekly gig now, right?
Yeah, that's the idea.
All right. We're talking to Mike Crane, WPR director, talking about what's going on here at Wisconsin Public Radio, our various networks. And you can join in on Mondays with Mike at 800-642-1234. What's on your mind about the shows you hear? Is there a particular program or type of show you'd like Wisconsin Public Radio to carry? What do you want to know about how WPR operates? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to WPR director Mike Crane about all things Wisconsin Public Radio on the April edition of Mondays with Mike. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Wisconsin Public Radio? What concerns, what bugs you, or what makes you happy about what you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've got some events coming up, Mike, at Wisconsin Public Radio. We've got a webpage, I guess, now where people can learn about them, all the stuff, WPR.org/presents. What kind of things can people find there?
Well, among the things are one more, at least, of our old-time radio drama live performance of The Canterville Ghost. And the next one is in Mineral Point on May 5th. And the previous shows in Wausau and Eau Claire sold very well. We think that they're going pretty well on the sales in Mineral Point. It's a lot of fun. It's a live radio play. Mm-hmm. Not for broadcast at this point. We've already broadcast it. But you get to see it perform live, and it's really neat.
And then I've been hearing about this, to the best of our knowledge, gig going on in Milwaukee.
Yeah, anyone who's been to one of their events knows that they are amazing, just like the radio show. And this one takes the topic of one of the things we love and need in life so much, which is water, and really takes some new twists on it. Ann Strangehaps, who's the host, is going to MC an evening of big ideas, provocative questions. We think you'll end up leaving inspired and awake and engaged. and lots of great people along with her from the show and personalities. There'll be some fun surprises in that. And that is April 19th, Turner Hall in Milwaukee. We hope to see you there.
And then a Simply Folk event coming up in June in Wausau?
Yeah, during our 100th anniversary year, we had a great party at the Rothschild Pavilion near Wausau, and we're headed back June 7th for another Simply Folk shindig with three great Wisconsin bands. And my notes don't tell me who those are yet, but they will be great.
But they're going to be good.
They are. We had a great time last time, a big crowd, and I trust we will again.
And people have to get tickets to these events.
Yeah.
And they're, what, $100, $500? What do these sell out at?
Well, the VIP tickets are sometimes, you know, closer to that. But no, we have some that are free, some that are sort of a basic gate price. It'll vary partly depending on the costs of doing that particular event. But we want to make sure there are always events that people can just participate in without any kind of a gate fee as well.
And again, that website, wpr.org/presents.
Yep, that's right.
I memorized it already. I lost where I had that in front of me.
Presents, plural. That's
presents.
Right. And in case you would like to keep up with this and everything else about WPR, don't forget wpr.org/radiowaves, which is our newsletter that we send out by email all the time.
We heard from Chip on Facebook. Chip says they want to hear fewer heavy subjects discussed on our shows, I guess more light or fun stuff. And this is kind of an eternal struggle for any talk show or anybody, Mike, the balance of hard news and current events and serious stuff and fun stuff. And there are people, having done this for a while, you know there are people on all sides of the spectrum among our listeners.
Oh, yeah. I think we've probably talked about this before on this segment of Mondays with Mike, but the inevitable dilemma of broadcasting is you're sending something out to thousands or hundreds of thousands or even millions of people in some cases, and it may not be the thing that you're interested in this hour, and so that's a challenge there. I've also seen over time some big word, periodicity, like during certain political seasons, lots of politics. During the summer, we tend to get lighter because there doesn't tend to be quite as much of the hard news sort of thing. But always, we want to have that mix of inspiration, entertainment, learning. All of that is a part of what we try to do.
Let's bring on another caller now. Marcy is with us in Stevens Point. Marcy, hi.
Hello. Hi. I would like to comment as a pretty consistent listener. I'm not much for TV, but I do have the radio on pretty much for hours. and my perception is a quality of the program is good. However, I'm noticing, at least from my ears, overemphasis on issues of racism. It's pretty much, from my ears, perpetual introduced as part of topics. The kind of the last straw for me was I was listening to a show about foods and cooking, and it was introduced. I thought, you know, it would be nice to hear just topics rather than specific group takes on them, issues we are Americans rather than dividing us up in issues of racism perpetually. It's extremely annoying as a listener, and I find it very divisive beyond that.
Well, thanks for the comment, Marcy. I certainly know that our motivation has nothing to do with divisiveness at all. What we find is that many groups feel as if they're not fully understood by the larger group of Americans and whatever group everyone else is in. And, you know, you're absolutely right that racism and issues surrounding it, and I'd say you could certainly add sexism and a lot of isms into that list, are very much in the air in our culture. And we do tend to be a reflection of our culture on NPR and WPR, and so that's why it's surfacing a lot. And very specific to WPR, one of our goals is to reflect the diversity and to be as inclusive as we can be in terms of who are the guests, and we're trying to also change who's employed here as we move over time so that we are, in fact, representative of all kinds of groups and viewpoints and so on the radio as well as in ourselves.
And when we talk about diversity on the show, that might mean racial or ethnic diversity. I know we try to track on our show.
Opinion diversity,
representing all parts of the state geographically. Are we leaving out parts of the state in our coverage? Are we doing too many people from Madison, Milwaukee, or not enough from the cities whatever. So it can mean a lot of different things.
Well, and obviously, thinking of some of the comments we've heard so far, some things will feel more divisive or serious, others lighter, and that can be quite a range. And so thank you for the comments, Marcy.
Marcy, thanks for the call. We're talking to WPR Director Mike Crane on Mondays with Mike. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mick is on the line in Racine. Mick, hi. Oh, Mick, are you still there? That was a sound I haven't heard before.
No, boom.
Okay. So in the interim, we've got some changes in the works in terms of our personnel here at WPR, some job openings, and a much, I think, anticipated what's going to happen in the morning here. What can you tell us about
that? Yeah, well, we will have a new Morning Drive host coming on board soon.
Crossing I's, dotting T's there.
That's right. Meanwhile, Kate is doing a terrific job, and we've been so grateful for her stepping in on fairly short notice, as it turned out, and just doing a wonderful job. And so she'll continue for the time being. And then we'll have an announcement and a reconfigured morning show probably as we head into the summer as they figure that all out. And yes, there are job openings. We've had a combination of new initiatives and some great people, as far as we're concerned, unfortunately leaving, whether that was to retirement or an exciting new opportunity. The way to find out about that, because people really do want to work at Wisconsin Public Radio, is WPR.org/jobs. And you'll see the whole listing of what's open right now right there.
And we've got a spring membership drive coming up, Mike, and an opportunity to get, I love these, I've got a couple of these, a new artist mug coming up.
Yeah, that's right. It's Karen Ann Hoffman, who does Iroquois raised beadwork, that has done the design for the mug this time. And so that's for people that give a gift of $15 a month or more. And also, this is neat, for the $10 a month pledge, people can choose the Reach Out and Read books for young children as their thank you gift. And that's brand new, developmentally and linguistically appropriate books for children. And you hear all about it during the drive. Of course, you can always donate, and it's WPR.org/donate.
And that drive coming up later this month. Time for another caller or two. Jim is with us in Watertown. Jim, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Listening to the radio not too long ago and talk about the vets that get sent to the war memorial there in D.C. And I got to thinking, there's a lot of stories there. And there's, you know, not just there, but a lot of old people, and we're losing them. And with them go the stories. Why doesn't somebody try and see if there's a way to let them tell their story and maybe even get a question and answer kind of thing, if that works out in the end, to kind of just see what it was, where we're going, and how far from back then we've come.
Jim, thanks for that call. Our friends at StoryCorps do something very much like that, but an interesting idea.
They do, and not only that, that's kind of a national effort that shows up in individual towns over time, but also our colleagues at Wisconsin Public Television, and we benefit from this work on the radio as well, have had an abiding interest in veterans, and that has meant talking, it's now a while ago, to World War II vets. They've been moving through, and right now they're talking to current era vets. They have a program they're working on called Veterans Coming Home, and they have definitely not ignored the people that Jim is talking about either, because it is a big deal to learn from our heroes and heroines what's on their mind these few or even many years later.
Jim, thanks for that suggestion. Just a few moments left, Mike. Let's talk technology a bit. How can people follow us on Facebook? That has changed recently.
Yeah, we now have a special page that's for the entire Ideas Network. So it's facebook.com/TheIdeasNetwork. Don't forget or the Ideas Network, if you say it that way. And so we'd love to have you follow us that way. Also, let's talk about those smart speakers. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are getting those as gifts, and we have a little tutorial. Just go to WPR.org, and on the lower left side, you'll see a link to a tutorial about how to set those so they'll listen to WPR.
Well, Mike, it's been fun listening to you. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to be here.
That's WPR Director Mike Crane with us the first Monday of every month for Mondays with Mike. Baseball season kicked off for real this chilly afternoon here in Wisconsin with the Brewers' home opener against the St. Louis Cardinals, and Run DMC was probably on the stadium playlist. Why? Because it's the walk-on song for starting pitcher Zach Davies when he comes up to bat, that is, not when he's pitching. As reported by WTMJ-TV in Milwaukee, there is an art to choosing just the right song when a batter comes up to the plate or a pitcher steps up to the mound. Brewers' walk-on songs lately have included ballpark classics like Welcome to the Jungle, new pop hits from Rihanna, and hard rock from Metallica. And it would be tough to pick that song because maybe you want something that gets you pumped up. You might want something that intimidates opponents, which I guess probably isn't realistically going to happen. And in that report from WTMJ, some batters have given playlists of 8 or so different songs. They want to shuffle, and maybe they want to be surprised at any particular moment. And, of course, you're never going to go up to bat 8 times in one game unless, you know, it's a really extra innings kind of game. I was thinking about mine, maybe Dirty Deeds by AC/DC. That's pretty rocket, or just the instrumental part from Kashmir by Zeppelin. That'd be pretty sweet. Pitcher Brent Suter has his favorite. He's been nicknamed the Raptor for his unique running style. His song of choice, the Jurassic Park theme song. This is Central Time.